Welcome to the 468th episode of the Jamie Delaney Plant-Based Wellness Podcast. My name is Jamie Delaney, and I'm your host. I'm a plant-based cardiologist and endurance athlete living in Southwest Florida. Thank you for listening. Well, I'm not much of an endurance athlete this week. I'm officially in running rehab. I've been trying to run through my posterior tibial tendinopathy / ankle tightness. Run seems like it's going to get a little bit better. I'm stiff afterwards, hobble, and Saturday went for a long run, which is not really a long run. It was a 10-mile run and started feeling a little bit worse. And I asked Michael, it's like, what's my gait look like? And he tried to describe that I was kind of looking like a C. I was bent one way and bent another way. And I said, can you just film me? And so he took a film took a video of me running, hobbling. And when I played it back, it was, oh no, whatever's going on with my foot, it's tracking upstream or vice versa. And I had what is called a Trendelenburg type of gait where I was collapsing with my collapsing to the right when I would hit and kind of dragging my foot through rather than actually using my glute, specifically the medial glute muscle. And so I came back and started digging into things, and it became, well, is it my glute that caused the problem with my ankle, or is my ankle caused the problem with my glute? Still not entirely sure, but both need to be addressed. And, I always talk to people about finding the root cause of what's going on as opposed to treating the symptoms. And again, my ankle area hurts, and that is what I like to grab. It's pretty quick, started feeling up the chain in my calf for what was tight, what was possibly pulled. And it's kind of a weird sensation that sometimes my ankle would hurt kind of in the over the ankle, sometimes up the inner side of my shin, sometimes even in the lateral outer aspect of my foot. So more than one thing was certainly going on. But when I came home and started to test my glute med, and one way you can do that is, see if you can hold an object, put your knee, put one knee against the wall and activate the, when you're standing on the other leg, you activate the glute medius muscle. Well, it wasn't activating on the right side. And I kind of knew there was a problem because I haven't been able to stand on one foot with my right leg. So I typically stand on my left foot and put my toe socks on and stand on my right foot and put my toe socks on before I ran the long haul 100 with no problem balancing. But now I can't balance on my right leg. And I attribute it to having this posterior tendon issue because when I try to balance on one on my right leg, it hurts along that posterior tibial tendon. So that kind of keeps me, I can't get my weight over to the other side. But it's weird in that I couldn't actually move my weight outside. So I couldn't get the weight to the outside of my foot without losing my balance the other way. So initially I was attributing to it just was pain. But now, I come to find out that this glute is not firing. So I've had to put myself into more rehab. So not only am I doing posterior tibial tendon things with eversion and inversion of my foot and toe raises with a ball on my heel and mobilization of my feet and rolling and some icing and some band work. And as this loosens up, I'm starting to feel that my feet were really tight. So I think I had a lot more tightness and stiffness in both feet, but particularly my right than I even realized. So that's improving. And then I started working on this glute med, and that's actually improving as well. And to test that, you can use one of the big stability balls and put it up against the wall and put your knee against it and stand on the other leg and see if you can get a minute The other things that you can do are, bridges. There's adductors when you pull your legs together versus push your leg abductors apart. If abductors are tight, sometimes some things don't work well. So doing some stretching there, stretching my quadriceps because that can cause your hip not to fire. So somewhat of a mess down here in Florida when it comes to some of the things that are going on, even though, I've been doing things to try to make myself stronger, I haven't been focusing in the right direction. So I think things are getting a little bit better. I have put myself on just walk mode for this past week, and so we'll see how that goes for a little bit longer. I've not got on my trainer because I was trying to see if I just walk a couple miles with the dog and let things kind of rest, would that help? Probably start adding some swimming in, see how that goes, and hopefully this will be behind me before long. But, it just goes back to, trying to make things go away quick and treating the symptoms. I did some cryotherapy last week directed at my ankle, and which is basically nitric oxide, nitric oxide gas, which is cold, 200 degrees minus Fahrenheit, and it made it feel good temporarily, just like maybe a chiropractic type of therapy, but it didn't last very long. I was treating the symptoms. I was treating the pain in my ankle. I thought if I could get the pain and swelling in my ankle to go away, maybe everything would magically get better. But again, obviously there's a lot more to it. And, I worked up. I didn't work up high enough. Took me a while. Have to admit, it usually does. Everybody tries. I'm no different from anybody else. If you can do a quick fix, that's what we're all about. I even looked at a video, and thank you for the emails. A couple of people suggested some videos, and they are pretty much what I was doing. But, people even suggested, wearing an insole temporarily to kind of support my arch, because that's kind of the pressure on my arch is causing part of the pain because I can't keep the weight off my arch. And while that helps a little bit, it kind of causes other issues. It pushes my toes up higher into my shoes, but it's also treating the cause. It's treating the symptom more so than it's treating the cause. And that's what I try to do in my practice: is look to treat the cause and not the symptoms. Instead of a temporary quick fix, whether it be a an arch support, a cryotherapy, or a medication, or some other sort of quick fix type of things. They really don't work. We have to address the root cause. I had a lady come in today that has severe kyphosis, so a severe curvature of the upper spine to the point where she's had multiple fractures of her thoracic spine. She has osteoporosis, so she was in severe pain, and I sent her for a neurosurgical evaluation to see if there's anything they had to offer, and they felt that there wasn't much to do other than perhaps put her in a brace. So she tried the brace, it was an automatic correction of years of her spine curving, and it was terribly, terribly painful and very, very disappointing because it didn't provide her with any kind of relief. It just caused more pain, and so that was the only solution. So we got to thinking, and her and I kind of brainstormed a little bit, and when she came into the office, I noticed that her shoulders were very, very hunched up to her ears, and turns out, after talking to her a little bit, that she's had a lifelong tendency to hunch her shoulders up, and it started as a protective mechanism when she was in school, that the teachers used to hit her, and she would pull her shoulders up to keep from getting hit in the face, and so that became a response that she's had to stress over time, or just as a protective mechanism. And then when her back started to hurt, things, that that also became a bracing mechanism for her to kind of protect her back. And, you know, she would not even notice it. And she said to me today that her husband of 56 years, he never noticed it. And she doesn't realize she's doing it, and then she can pull her shoulders down. But, it's a very... it's been a protective mechanism for her for so long that it was hard not to. But the way she was contracting her shoulders up and had her shoulder blades probably contributed a whole lot to the actual curvature of her spine. So, you know, we started working with some engagement of her abdominal muscles and her low rib and her back and glutes to try to get her a little bit straighter, but also get those muscles engaged to help support her back, and then work on ways that we could get her shoulders to relax and get her shoulder blades down and get them more mobile and not hunched all the time. But, you know, it just goes to show that, again, starting to look at the why something's happening is very important so that we can address the mechanism. And it doesn't matter what age you have, whether you have bunions or fixed whatever, you can always make a little bit more progress, and you can always gain a little muscle mass and a muscle mobility and strength that can decrease pain. You know, we know that people can have x-rays that really looked awful, but if you take the inflammation out and you have good muscle support, they can do pretty good, even though, you know, they're not a perfect specimen, so to speak. And I think we all get caught up in making things look anatomically pretty when, you know, years of life have led us to grow certain ways, and we have to figure out how we can best use those ways to our advantage and to continue to get ourselves out of pain. So she has a good nutrition plan on board. It's just a matter of getting some mobilization things. And so we even had her just take two small weights in each hand to kind of feel her arms being pulled down so she can get her shoulders down, actually relax them and get those cues. And, you know, again, everybody needs cues to try to learn a new behavior, whether it's mobility and strength, or perhaps the cues to learn a behavior about eating, what, you know, whether you're full or what cues set you off or what cues get you in trouble, so to speak. So it kind of all comes around and works out. I was taught as a cardiology fellow that your heart is of normal, you know, a normal size when you're, you know, young and healthy. And there's a certain amount of muscle that's appropriate. Anything thicker than that would be considered a hypertrophied heart. Depending on where that muscle is increased, you can tell whether it could be pathologic, in that if the muscle actually becomes so thick that the blood can't really get out of the heart when the heart squeezes, or it becomes pathological if the heart muscle is thickened, but then the heart muscle actually becomes somewhat scarred and it can't actually relax. So it can contract but can't relax, and that can lead to what we call diastolic dysfunction, and people get short of breath. Even though their systolic function of their heart's ability to contract looks very vigorous, it can't relax. Therefore, they get short of breath and actually can have heart failure, fluid on their lungs. The other thing that can happen is the heart muscle can become weakened and thin over time. And so the muscle cavity of the heart starts to enlarge. The muscle is somewhat stretched. If you think about, I was actually taught, like a rubber band, if you stretch a rubber band too far, it loses its ability to recoil back. And so if the muscle fibers are stretched too far, it ultimately, the heart actually loses its ability to contract. And so you have this big, baggy heart, and the muscle somewhat thin. So those were the spectrums that I was taught and have pretty much practiced my entire career. But now there's some information that's looking at what happens to your heart muscle when you lose muscle mass and you age. And they've actually noted that when people lose muscle mass, they can actually lose heart mass, so that they're at risk for heart failure. So in somewhat, it's another thing added onto the spectrum. Usually we think people's heart muscle gets thicker over time when they get high blood pressure. But in fact, these particular people that lose muscle mass are also losing cardiac mass, and it's called cardiac sarcopenia. And it's independent of blood pressure. It's independent of age. It's basically associated with muscle mass. So it's another reason to kind of hit the gym to maintain muscle mass, because they're very heavily correlated, it seems. Chicken or the egg, not entirely sure, but probably metabolically related. If you look at some of the etiologies, there's a gene associated with metabolism, both fat and glucose metabolism, that is improved with physical activity, and that tends to go down in people with heart failure and with this cardiac sarcopenia. C-reactive protein, which is an inflammatory marker, and interleukin-6, which is an inflammatory marker, tend to go up when this mass is associated with a loss of muscle mass and a loss of strength, and can also be associated with decreased coronary blood flow and overall cardiac function. And again, this comes back to skeletal muscle mitochondria and probably cardiac mitochondria and our ability to metabolize fat and carbohydrate, as well as the inflammatory conditions associated with, you know, oxidative stress from what we eat, and insulin resistance. So it goes kind of one step further, this metabolic syndrome that we are, you know, describing more and more. The heart is probably part of that, in that the heart muscle also starts to weaken and the number of cells start to go down. So I thought that was actually pretty interesting. And of course, what can you do, or how can you define it? And you can actually look at body composition for skeletal muscle with a DEXA scan, just like you look for bone health. The bioelectrical impedance measurements, so the scales, the fancy scales at the gym, can also determine your muscle mass. So that's one thing you can track. You know, the scales we have at home, I'm not sure exactly how accurate they are, but I would think that it would be reasonable for someone to track it over time to see if it's changing. Now, obviously, it's not going to change in a week. And, you know, when people come in my office and they say, oh, you know, I gained 5 pounds, but it's all muscle, that's usually not so. But it may be something to track over time if you saw a general trend in a good direction, or perhaps you saw a trend in the other direction over time. The other thing that has been correlated is hand grip, you know, simple hand grip ability to squeeze. And I talked about that the last podcast. There are certain limits for men and women, but again, it's another reason to carry things, to grip things, to hang from things, to maintain your grip strength, because you're, you know, if you hang from a bar with your hands, you're actually working a lot more than just your hands and you know, working your back. But if you're lifting weights, you're using your hands to grip. So keep your hand grip strong, and you might keep your heart mass good and subsequently do better overall. Aerobic exercise is also good to maintain mitochondrial function. So, you know, it all comes back to the same prescription: strength training and aerobic exercise. There's also been association with white blood cell telomere length and cardiac function. So it seems as though our telomeres start to shrink. It is also a risk factor for cardiac dysfunction and possible heart failure. So some people are proposing that, you know, there's some screening methods to look at telomere length. Unfortunately, currently, the reliability of these tests are not very good, and they can vary quite widely with person-to-person tests. So maybe on the horizon, but again, for now, you know, keep walking, keep doing your strength training, keep your hand gripped up, and I think we don't need much in the way of fancy tests. With regard to fancy tests, there are now some tests that can measure DNA molecules in the plasma and urine, and they can look at fragments and see whether or not there's a problem with the DNA. One such thing is the methylation status. And there's also ability to do some DNA sequencing. And this is not really new. Prenatal testing for genetic abnormalities uses a similar type procedure, looking at chromosomes and DNA from the fetus, because you actually see fetal DNA in the mother's plasma. It's also been used to look at organ rejection and transplant to see whether or not there's some abnormalities that can detect early graft rejection. But anyway, this test to look at colon cancer, they actually looked at plasma in 7,861 people with a mean age of 60 for methylation status and fragmentation and gene variation. And what they found was that this blood test could had what's called a sensitivity, or the ability to pick up the cancer, of about 83%. However, that meant that there was a 17% chance that they would not pick up the cancer. And then the other indicator is specificity, and that was 90%. So 90%, if that test suggests you had cancer, that was 90% accurate, meaning 10% of the people that said they said they'd have cancer would not have cancer. So that would be what we call a false positive test. The problem was it wasn't able to pick up early cancer, or those polyps that might be transitioning to a precancerous lesion. Its ability to detect that was only 13%. It seemed the older you were, the more likely the test was to be accurate. But it still wasn't as good as what we call FIT test, which detects hemoglobin in the stool. The original stool test used peroxide to test for blood. The FIT test tests for hemoglobin in the stool, and is actually one of the first tests that actually show a mortality benefit by detecting cancer. So more so than even colonoscopy when it comes down to it. When you look at, you can't really get hurt by a stool test, but you can get hurt by colonoscopy if it wasn't indicated. So while the blood test seems, you know, an easy thing to do, or thought, you know, it's billed as, well, find out whether you have cancer early and, you know, you don't have to undergo any kind of a screening, you know, colonoscopy. Yeah, you could probably avoid a colonoscopy, but you're not going to pick up the lesions that, you know, you might have saved somebody for. And that's really the problem with a lot of testing, is that the cancers that you really need to find early, you probably can't pick up. The ones that probably weren't going to kill you anyway, you can pick up. And you also always have to take into account, you know, what kind of harm did the test do? So, you know, does an abnormal test lead to a procedure that might cause harm and there's nothing you can do? Or does an abnormal test lead to a treatment that you can do and save somebody if you find something early enough? And that really hasn't panned out with most of our testing at this point. We don't look enough at overall survival. If I cure you from your breast cancer but you die of coronary artery disease, that really doesn't count that we saved you from breast cancer. So we need to focus on therapies that are going to improve overall survival from all causes, not just the cause that we're focusing on. There is this view that if we hit things hard and heavy early on, that we're going to improve survival. But the only way we're testing it is if we're looking at whether or not there was recurrence of disease. So the reality of a lot of the testing looks at whether the tumor comes back or the tumor grows, but not if the person lives longer. And there was a study in the Journal of American Medical Association just published looking at whether giving a complete suppression of ovarian function versus just tamoxifen or aromatase inhibitor is better. And they looked they looked basically, again, at disease-free survival, meaning survival without the tumor coming back. And they looked at it in estrogen receptor positive women that were premenopausal, and it was not randomized. It was observational. There was a differences in the grades and previous chemotherapy, so it was a little bit mishmash. But the primary goal was recurrent free survival. And they start out with 3,434 people, and they excluded people for whatever, got down to 2,647, and they end up having 2,260 people get tamoxifen alone, 232 people get tamoxifen plus ovarian function suppression therapy, 155 got aromatase inhibitors and ovarian function suppression. And then they looked at 192 people that got therapy for over 2 years and 195 people that got both of those therapies less than 2 years. The tamoxifen group was, the aromatase and tamoxifen was for 5 years. So they looked at really overall 5 years. There was no benefit to the ovarian function suppression. Tamoxifen did just as good or better than anything. And this was an observational study because they wanted to see if they could repeat the results that were done to really establish that women should get ovarian suppression as well as tamoxifen aromatase therapy, because some of those earlier, again, not survival studies, but recurrence-free survival studies, showed better function, better outcomes if you had ovarian suppression on top of these things. But again, there's so many studies, and the people are different within the studies. They weren't randomized. They weren't placebo controlled. They didn't look for overt overall survival for a long period of time. And it's a little disheartening that, you know, we've been dealing with, and these therapies aren't new therapies, that they've been out there for such a long time and nobody's bothering to look at overall survival. And the therapies have side effects. This, you know, we know that complete estrogen suppression is associated with increased cardiovascular risk factors and a whole host of other things, osteoporosis, bone fractures, and on and on. So to say that we want to give people all these therapies up front as opposed to perhaps staging them if something comes along, or whether people, you know, is there a difference when people are 35 versus 45? It's a long time for a woman to undergo ovarian suppression plus tamoxifen therapy if they're 35 versus 48 or 49, and they were already going into menopause anyway. So, you know, again, we're, you know, drug companies and, you know, and results come with these therapeutic modalities, but we're not looking at the big picture. How do people actually do, and what's the quality of their life with some of these therapies? And, you know, some of the changes that, you know, some of the small percentages that improve disease-free recurrence even, you know, if you got somebody's weight down to normal and you had them eat plant-based and you had them exercise, we know all those things decrease the risk of breast cancer recurrence and certainly not a lot of other cancer recurrences. Why aren't we doing those? Why aren't we focusing on those? You know, it's just the opposite. Again, we target the therapy. Here's your disease and here's the therapy. We're not addressing the root cause. Why did you get cancer in the first place? Was there something, is there some risk factor that we can modify? Why did you get coronary artery disease in the first place? Is there some risk factor that we can modify, some lifestyle factor that we can change so that these things won't progress? You know, I think of these guys that we met, you know, at long haul, 75 and 78, running, you know, the 100-mile race. You know, these guys have a great advantage. Their skeletal muscle is still intact. Their cardiac muscle is probably looks pretty good. Their risk of heart failure is very low. We know that the if you're between 60 and 75, your risk of coronary artery disease is in the 70% if you're not doing something to change things actively. And it can be, you know, over 80, 90%, over 80. But these people are, you know, spitting into the wind because they're keeping active and their bodies, they're maintaining their bodies in a functional state, their mitochondria in a functional state that allows them to metabolize nutrients and to keep going. So I'm not saying everybody out needs to go out and run 100 miles, but I think that most people need to make a little bit more time for exercise and nutrition before they just say yes to some of these spot therapies that, yeah, you don't have to do anything for. It's done to you, and you're given some numbers that might make you feel better, but in the long run, we're not really sure what's going to happen. If you're interested in taking control of your health future, or you would like some help figuring out what the root cause of your problem is and how best to attack it, head on over to our website, drdulaney.com, drdulaney. We love to help you no matter where you live, kind of go over things and help troubleshoot. That's what I enjoy most, whether it's nutritional troubleshooting or musculoskeletal troubleshooting. I enjoy helping people work through that, and I believe that we all can play a big role in our ultimate health outcomes. Thanks for listening.